But out of respect to our other speakers, Suzanne Condon is next, and she's the Associate Commissioner, the Director of the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, Bureau of Environmental Health, and leads a team of public health professionals, including epidemiologists, toxicologists, consultant physicians, indoor air, emergency response specialists, regulatory inspectors, and environmental scientists and health educators. And in her spare time, she has appeared on numerous national news and science programs, 2020, NOVA, ESPN, and 60 Minutes. She holds a Bachelor's of Science from Bridgewater State College and a Master's of Science from Emmanuel College.
Okay, so I'll answer the question. I actually got called by ESPN 60 about a year or so ago because Massachusetts was the only state in the country that actually regulated indoor skating rink air quality. And so they were doing a big story about all these children that were getting exposed to carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide. So that's my latest, but it was really neat to be on a sports gotcha. It was fun. So anyway, I'm going to try to go through these slides pretty quickly, but I will say that I hope I'm not the outlier, but I believe that I've been incredibly fortunate to work in the state of Massachusetts for all of my career because we have always partnered with our state laboratory. It is if environmental health programs is the left arm, the laboratory is the right arm, and that's the only way that we've really been able to fully serve the people who live in our communities across the state. I have no relationships to disclose, work for the government, not a lot of dollars there, but the passionate work that we do. Just wanted to briefly mention the long-standing partnership that we have had between the Bureau of Environmental Health and the Bureau of Laboratory Sciences, and notably, I should say, the Division of Environmental Chemistry. That has been clearly our strongest partner. I want to give a couple examples where we had community questions that we could have answered using traditional environmental health assessment methods, but they were really made much more comprehensive by partnering with our lab and through biomonitoring specifically. And then I'll just give a quick summary at the end. So this is just an example of the types of things that we've worked with our state lab on. We've obviously always partnered in support of our childhood lead poisoning prevention program. Massachusetts has one of the strongest programs in the country, despite the fact that we've lost all of our federal funding. We are one of a handful of states that require universal blood lead screening. So if you have a child in Massachusetts age 0 to 3, they must be blood lead tested. If they live in a high-risk area, they have to be tested at age 4, and a child is not allowed to go to school in Massachusetts until they can demonstrate what their blood lead level is. And so we take that very seriously. Getting to Amanda's question about resources, we did a couple of studies really looking at massive exposure to PCBs as a result of a national priority list site down in New Bedford. And in fact, what we did when we designed that grant application, we had staff that we paid for staff positions for the state lab and staff positions for environmental health. And so that's sort of one of the ways to make sure when you're asked these larger questions, how you get enough resources. I won't go through all of them because I want to focus on these two examples, but suffice to say that I don't think I would want to be in charge of these programs if I didn't have a strong laboratory to work with. So the two examples involve PCB exposure concerns at an elementary school in Massachusetts and a unique situation involving a pretty large mercury spill at another elementary school in Massachusetts. So I'm going to start with the Sherwood Middle School, and this really was trying to address concerns over indoor environmental exposures and health effects. Most of our schools in Massachusetts are pretty old, and so the likelihood that PCB-containing building materials are present is pretty high. So the staff that worked for me in the toxicology and indoor air quality programs were asked to evaluate indoor environmental concerns at this particular middle school. And they were asked that in large part because there were a large number of women that had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and they believed that environmental factors were playing a role. So I, of course, called our partners at the state lab and said, any chance we can do some biomonitoring and see if we can figure out what PCB levels might be. And I think it's safe to say that the while the epidemiologic evidence is sometimes conflicting, that most health agencies do believe that PCBs are reasonably anticipated to cause cancer, and further, that some studies have also been conducted to understand more about possible environmental influences on breast cancer, and because PCBs have those estrogen-like properties, they may indeed affect breast cancer risk. So we worked with a team of teachers and such and folks who lived in the community, local health, and the lab, and we basically said we're gonna embark on a series of activities. So first we're going to do indoor air quality evaluations. We're going to do some indoor environmental tests. We're going to do an exposure assessment based on some of those tests. But then we're also going to collect serum PCB levels for the folks who worked at the school. And then we issued some guidance on how best to wrestle with PCB-containing materials in schools and public buildings in Massachusetts. So the environmental sample collection, here's the sort of traditional way you might answer this question if you're an environmental health practitioner. We did a lot of white samples to look for the presence of PCBs and dust throughout the school, and we took air samples. We took two samples indoors and obviously one outdoors for comparison purposes. The samples were collected starting in the late afternoon on a Friday outside of regular school activities. We didn't want to disrupt the activities at the school, but we also wanted to restrict access to the samples because we needed to have confidence in the results. The good news is that all sample results were well below the U.S. EPA regulatory cleanup levels, but the EPA regulatory cleanup levels are a bit higher than what some other states have published, and that so we looked at the California cleanup guidelines. And while some of these samples were a little bit higher than that, it just really suggested they needed more aggressive cleaning. And on the your left-hand side of this slide is the indoor air testing results. So here's where you get into a little bit of problem if you only have exposure data based on environmental sample results. So in the rooms that we tested, both of these rooms had levels that exceeded the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry's cancer risk evaluation guides. And specifically, when that happens, we then have to explain to people that it's simply a screening value because people think automatically they've been exposed to high levels. So in order to best understand that, we did a cancer risk assessment for the middle school, assuming a worst-case scenario. So we assumed that all adults were exposed to those levels for 35 years, 8 hours a day. I don't know about the rest of the states that are here, but we have a lot of teachers that are long-term teachers, and so we wanted to have worst-case scenario. And we assumed that children were exposed to these levels for 8 hours a day for 180 days per year for 4 years. The middle school, we were hoping most kids were out of that middle school within that four-year window. Should be out in three, but we'll go for four. And so for adults, the cancer risk was estimated at one excess cancer in a population of 100,000, which is pretty acceptable in the cancer risk world. And for children, it was much lower than that. The estimated cancer risk was one to two excess cancers in a population of 1 million. But as I said, we worked closely with the state laboratory staff on this, and so we coordinated with the environmental chemistry program staff to ensure we collected the samples in the right way and the transportation was consistent, I think getting at some of what Heidi was talking about. This sampling took place over 4 days in December of 2009. We worked with a school nurse. We're fortunate to have great school nurses in Massachusetts, so they collected the blood samples for us. In all, 52 staff participated and signed consent forms and participated in pre-draw interviews. So the great news was that with serum PCB results, they sort of reassured people that all of our other estimates were pretty much on target, that almost all of the participants were within the 95th percentile of PCB levels available from CDC's NHANES data. Two participants did exceed the NHANES 95th percentile, but that's where those interviews came in handy. They were heavy, heavy fish eaters, and so that wasn't surprising that they had somewhat higher PCB levels. And as a result of both the environmental test results and the biomonitoring, school personnel were reassured that the indoor environmental conditions were not likely to be associated with breast cancer. So I think it's a comprehensive way of trying to address a question. This other example is one that I'd like to say that it, you know, we don't have this happen very often. We don't have the situation I'm going to tell you about happen very often, but I will tell you that in the last 4 or 5 weeks, we've actually had 3 mercury spills in schools. I don't know what it is, but we've got to figure out some messaging on this. So this involved an evaluation of exposure and health concerns among adults and children from a mercury spill in a Worcester elementary school. That's sort of in the central part of the state. So here's what happened. A student brings in a pint bottle of elemental mercury. Where'd this kid get a pint bottle? His dad worked in metals reclamation. And so in any case, somebody gave his dad this and said, hey, you could probably get some money for this. The dad brings it home, and unfortunately, he doesn't secure that. And so the kid takes it, brings it into school. What happens when a kid spills something they're not supposed to have? Well, they don't tell anybody, right? So the kid spills all sorts of mercury on the third floor. I think it was the third floor of this building. Then the child showed the teacher back down, a couple floors down, what he had brought to school, and she immediately contacted the assistant principal. I don't know why the assistant principal felt the need to open the vial of mercury. She confiscated the bottle but left it in the office overnight and actually left it uncapped. And school officials contacted the local fire department the next morning. Worcester Fire Department arrived on scene, took a look at the silvery metal-looking object, and obviously knew it was likely to be mercury. The Jerome meter testing confirmed that. State Hazmat paged me. This usually happens at 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning, but luckily for me, this was in the middle of the week and only later in the day. Environmental sampling then demonstrated that mercury had been spread throughout the entire building, because what happens when people spill stuff on a floor, the custodial staff, it was sort of like, really? They clean that often? And so, yeah, they did. And air samples for mercury ranged from 2,000 to 44,000 nanograms per cubic meter. Just to give you perspective, the federal guidance level for residential occupancy is 1,000. So these levels were sky high. That evening, we worked with local officials to contact parents and have people bring the students, have the students bring their clothing and knapsacks and stuff to school, because we wanted to screen them for mercury. So the children in the affected school building were in grades 2 to 6, area of major concern for parents. We again contacted our partners at the state lab. Help, help, lots of kids exposed, and lots of teachers too. So our staff that work in the programs I'm responsible for picked up sample kits and blank consent forms from our partners at the lab. And then our staff and nurses at the school and the local health department set up a coordinating center to obtain medical consent forms and collect urine specimens the next day. This is where I am the lab, one of the lab's biggest cheerleaders. I couldn't say more about the people who work at our state lab, and specifically in the environmental chemistry program. Our staff stayed at the school until 8:30 that night, but our state lab partners stayed at the state lab to receive those samples. It was 11 o'clock at night. And then laboratory staff worked until early morning hours to prepare the samples for analysis. In all, we had collected 188 samples. This is the participation who we collected them from. So here's what happens at the lab. On Thursday, September 23rd, as I said, late in the evening, they receive 188 specimens. They log them in. They prepare them for analysis. They then begin a 3-day shift starting on a Friday. And then on Saturday, they complete the testing. They adjust for creatinine and do data cleaning, because our lab staff are really sharp. They don't want to give us any results we can't rely on. All of the samples analyzed were reported as non-detect, thank goodness. It was less than a reporting limit, so therefore no health effects were expected for any participants based on the urine analyses. And this included those at greatest risk of exposure, those on the third floor where the child dropped this. We then sent individual letters explaining the urine results to all of the participants, obviously paying attention to HIPAA. And so to summarize, let me also say one thing. This is one where we got into a little bit of a disagreement with some of our sister agencies. There was a real push because some of these levels were around 600 nanograms, some of the what we detected on children's backpacks. This was a primarily low-income minority neighborhood where this school was. And I said, are you kidding me? Do you think these kids are sleeping with their knapsacks? They've got, I mean, so on some of the stuff, we knew it would go away over time, but they wanted us to tell children who probably only had one pair of shoes to throw out their shoes. So this is where I think public health people, I'm sorry, but I think we get it a lot of the time. We have to put science together with reality and think about what these results mean. So anyway, just to summarize, the partnership between environmental health programs and environmental labs is critical in designing optimal exposure assessment. Having protocols in place in advance of emergencies, like these last several weeks, allows for more rapid response. Use of biomarkers as indicators of exposure, along with interview data, allows for more comprehensive assessment of environmental exposure and health risk. And with more comprehensive response, health officials can better address community concerns. So thank you very much.